So with new resolve, they took off for I again. We have purged the camp of the sin. We have learned our lesson, God, and they took off for I again. And this time we're very successful. It's interesting that in chapter 8, when I is destroyed, you see Joshua coming up with a whole new tactic of warfare. That hadn't been done. I mean, Jericho was new, obviously. That was a big deal. But here we have ambushes set and feints and all kinds of other things that Joshua had figured out how to fight. And his men had figured out how to follow him. And they do very well. Very well in Ai. God had told them when you're going in here, don't make any deals. Don't marry these people. I'm going to drive them out in front of you. In chapter 9, you have these folks that are Gibeonites who had certainly heard that Jericho was up in smoke, who had certainly heard about the rout at Ai. And these folks, these Gibeonites, they come to them faking that they had been on a long journey. And they basically said, listen, we're from far away. We're just traveling through here, and we want no trouble with you folks. Please make a treaty with us. Please tell us that you won't hurt us. And so the men of Israel, the leaders, without consulting God, make a deal with the Gibeonites. They say, oh, well, you're from far away? Oh, okay. They even had moldy bread with them. Said, look, we've been traveling so long, our bread's moldy. And they said, oh, well, you poor guys, you know. You've been on the road a long time, and yeah, we'll make a deal with you. They lived over the next hill. So now we have a treaty that's formed with some people that we're not supposed to form treaties with, and it got bad. Because other people came and attacked the Gibeonites, and now Joshua and the Israelites were in a position where they had to go and defend them. And it just was the beginning. Okay? Now I want to move on to another great Sunday school story. I don't remember this one from Sunday school as much. But the five kings of the Amorites went to Gibeon, and they're attacking Gibeon. Joshua marches up with his entire army, including all his best fighting men. And the Lord said, guess what the Lord said? Do not be afraid of them. Once again, I have given them into your hand, and not one of them will be able to withstand you. After an all-night march, Joshua took them by surprise. So he's got his whole army that marches all night long, and then at dawn, they attack and take them by surprise. They must have been tired, right? They had done all that, and then they start fighting, and they start fighting, and they start fighting, and they keep fighting. The Lord hurled large hailstones down on them, and more died by the hail and were killed by the swords of the Israelites. This is a good day. It is going well. And then, on the day that the Lord gave the Amorites over to Israel, Joshua said to the Lord in the presence of Israel, sun, stand still over Gibeon, and you, moon, over the valley. So the sun stood still, and the moon stopped, until Israel avenged itself on its enemies. The sun stopped in the middle of the day and delayed going down about a full day. There's never been a day like it before or since. Because at Joshua's request, God stopped the sun so that they would have daylight to take vengeance on these people. And it stayed there, and it stayed there, and it stayed there. Now, we could go, oh yeah, cool story, right? But do you know that in Chinese writings, in Mayan writings, in Native American traditions, dating back to the same time, there's writings of a day that was about twice as long as it should have been. Or, depending on what part of the world there is, they're in, writings of a night It was about twice as long as it should have been. We can hear stories like this and dismiss it and go, maybe not. But when it's corroborated in other ancient writings, it just makes me go, what was going on? I read a fascinating paper by a guy who had all kinds of speculations about comets and slowing of the Earth's rotations and all kinds of things like that. That was really pretty cool, including the hailstones that were falling and all that stuff. It was really cool paper. I don't know if any of it's true. All I know is that the sun stopped, and they kept fighting, and they kept fighting. And can you imagine the exhaustion of these guys who had marched all night long and then had to fight 2 days worth of daylight? And God says, I'm going to do it, 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 and it all happens. So, we're going to finish up the book of Joshua, and then we're going to take a little break, okay? Joshua chapters 10 through 13 kind of talks about, you know, the southern cities are conquered, the northern kings are defeated, they're doing a great job at routing these people. God says, I will send them out like hornets are chasing them. And it goes on, and it goes on, and it goes on, until we get to chapter 13. Then Joshua had grown old. The Lord said to him, you are now very old. And there are still many very large areas of land to be taken over. This is the land that remains. And then he listed the Philistines, the Geshurites, from the Shihor River on the east to Egypt, and all this stuff that needs to be taken. As for all the inhabitants of the mountainous regions from Lebanon, all that, I myself will drive them out before the Israelites. Be sure to allocate this land to Israel for inheritance. Then the next chapters are basically the divisions of those lands for the different tribes. This tribe gets this land, this tribe gets that land, and so forth and so on. And so that contains a whole lot of information that we don't understand because we don't have the geographical understanding. But after all this is taken over, there's still some things here and there that need to be done. The eastern tribes cross back over the Jordan. They go home. And then Joshua has a farewell to his folks. And I want to read some of this. After a long time had passed, and the Lord had given Israel rest from all their enemies around them, Joshua, by then very old, summoned all of Israel, their elders, leaders, judges, and officials. And he said to them, I am very old. You yourselves have done everything the Lord God has done to all. You have seen everything the Lord your God has done to all these nations for your sake. It was the Lord your God who fought for you. Remember how I have allotted as an inheritance for your tribes all the land of the nations that remain. The nations I conquered between the Jordan and the Mediterranean Sea in the west. The Lord your God will push them out for your sake. He will drive them out before you. And you will take possession of their land as the Lord your God promised. Be very strong. Be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, without turning aside to the right or left. Do not associate with these nations that remain among you. Do not invoke the names of their gods or swear by them. You must not serve them or bow down to them, but you are to hold fast to the Lord your God as you have until now. The Lord has driven out before you great and powerful nations. To this day, no one has been able to withstand you. One of you routs 1,000 because the Lord your God fights for you just as he promised. So be very careful to love the Lord your God. But if you turn away and ally yourselves with the survivors of these nations that remain among you, and if you intermarry with them and associate with them, then you may be sure that the Lord your God will no longer drive out these nations before you. They will become snares and traps for you, whips on your back and thorns in your eyes until you perish from this good land which the Lord your God has given you. He warns them straight out. You must finish the job. If you relax, if you marry these people, if you worship their gods, it will be trouble. And so he convenes the people again. He renews the covenant at Shechem. He talks to them. He reads the law of Moses. And he says, "Now fear the Lord and serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away your gods, the gods your ancestors worshipped beyond the Euphrates River in Egypt." They still had those. You hear that? We've been in the wilderness for 40 years. We've been in the promised land. We've kicked the tails of everyone around us, and they still have gods and idols in their tents. Get rid of them and serve the Lord. "But if serving the Lord seems undesirable to you, then choose for yourselves this day who you will serve, whether the gods your ancestors served beyond the Euphrates or the gods of the Amorites in whose land you are living. But as for me and my household, we'll serve the Lord." And the people answered, "Far be it from us, far be it from us to forsake the Lord to serve other gods. It was the Lord our God himself who brought us and our parents out of Egypt from the land of slavery and performed these great signs before our eyes. He protected us in our entire journey and among all the nations. And the Lord drove out before us all the nations, including the Amorites who lived in the land. We too will serve the Lord because he is God." Joseph said, "You're not able to serve the Lord. He's a holy God. He will not forgive your rebellion and your sins. If you forsake the Lord and serve foreign gods, he will turn and bring disaster on you." The people were warned. The people were warned. The people were warned. And they said, "Far be it from us to do such a thing." So, Joshua dies. They bury him in the promised land. End of Joshua. End of the book of Joshua. So, what do you think? How many of these stories you went, "Oh yeah, I remember hearing that," or "Oh yeah, I remember reading that"? Did it seem familiar? Or was there all kinds of new stuff? Matt says no. He had a handle on it. No new information, man. The name of the file? Yeah. That was worth coming tonight, wasn't it? Learn the name of a new place. What would it have been like to be there with those people? I mean, it just seems so foreign to me. I don't know about you, but you're without electricity.
Probably smelly.
It was probably smelly. It would seem kind of crazy.
And they're performing minor surgical procedures there. Mm-hmm.
With flint knives, it says so in the. What would it be like to come into a land and say, "This is ours now because God says it is"? And you just go through. Bill, what?
When I hear that story, it's sort of. I think the Israelites had to be. At that point, they had an immense amount of faith. To go through circumcision at that point in time, because they all knew a story about two of their ancestors, Levi and Simeon, who used that to get rid of a whole group of people.
Right.
You know, and they thought, well, what if these guys in Babylon have heard of that story? That means we're open prey.
Right.
We're fair game, and we got no way to defend ourselves. So, you know, that had at that point. You know, that had to show tremendous faith in God to do that, I think. And,
mm-hmm. Right
outside the walls of Jericho. They lay themselves bare and vulnerable.
Yep.
You know, right when they're the people in people in
Jericho?
Jericho, that's what I'm looking for. The Jericho, right when they know that these guys are here to kill us, they lay themselves on the ground prostrate to the Lord.
Yep.
And that's such an example for us, that when we think we've got all going, the only way we can win is by laying ourselves down and giving up all the strength we think we have to rely on God's strength. That story is always hit, because I mean they know the story, you know. They know what happens when you do that.
Right. Good point. I'd never thought about that before. It was a lot of trust.
Yeah, it is a tremendous amount, I think.
Is it warm in here? You're all acting a little sleepy.
Good meal.
Good meal. All right, the fur will fly in Judges, trust me. A couple things you need to know about the book of Judges. First of all, what you read in the book of Judges from the first chapter to the last is not necessarily in chronological order. It is a collection of stories, okay? So if you want to read it in chronological order, I can't tell you what that order is, okay? You just have to accept that this is a cycle of stories. And it is a cycle of behavior of the Israelites. You got this little graphic here. Israel serves the Lord, falls into sin, enslaved, cries out, God raises up a judge, Israel is delivered. Around and around. Back and forth. Seven cycles in the book of Judges where this happens and happens and happens. Judges are interesting people because as we read the book, we realize that there may or may not have been anything special, but that God would raise them up. I'm not going to go into detail on the story of Gideon tonight, but here's a guy who God just shows up and says, "You're on, baby. This is it." And he says, "What? Wait, me?" Okay. So it would happen that way, that God's spirit would suddenly start talking to somebody and say, "Guess what? You're the one. You're the one." And God would raise up these people to do amazing things, to throw off the yoke of slavery. And we wonder, why was there a yoke of slavery to begin with? Chapter 1, verse 19. The Lord was with the men of Judah. They took possession of the hill country. But they were unable to drive the people from the plains because they had chariots fitted with iron. As Moses had promised, Hebron was given to Caleb, who drove from it the three sons of Anak. The Benjamites, however, did not drive out the Jebusites, who were living in Jerusalem to this day. The Jebusites lived there with the Benjamites. Now the house of Joseph attacked Bethel, and the Lord was with them, and when they sent men out to spy Bethel, the spies saw a man coming out of the city, and they said to him, "Show us how to get into the city, and we will see that you are treated well." So he showed them. And he then went to the land of the Hittites, where he built a city called Luz, and it is there to this day. But Manasseh did not drive out the people of Bethshan, or Tanakh, or Dor, or Ibrahim, or Megiddo. And it goes on and on about how they got part of the way there and they didn't finish the job. They got part of the way there and they didn't finish the job. And so what we have in the beginning of Judges is an outline of the mission failure. They had it. They had the mandate from God. God had promised them that I'm going to drive these people out in front of you, and they just didn't do it. They got tired. And I can understand to some degree. I mean, after a while, killing people probably isn't fun anymore, right? Jeff laughs. So, we're moving on to chapter 2, where it really lays it out. After Joshua had dismissed the Israelites, they went to take possession of the land, each to their own inheritance. People served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua, and the elders who outlived him, and all who had seen the great things the Lord had done for Israel. Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110, and they buried him in the land of his inheritance. After that whole generation had been gathered to their ancestors, another generation grew up who knew neither the Lord nor what he had done for Israel. Then the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord and served the Baals, and they forsook the Lord and the God of their ancestors who had brought them out of Egypt. They followed and worshipped various gods of the peoples around them. They aroused the Lord's anger because they forsook him and served Baal and the Asherahs. And in his anger against Israel, the Lord gave them into the hands of raiders who plundered them. He sold them into the hands of their enemies all around, whom they were no longer able to resist. And whenever Israel went out to fight, the hand of the Lord was against them to defeat them, just as he had sworn to them, and they were in great distress. Then the Lord raised up judges who saved them out of the hands of these raiders. Yet they would not listen to their judge, but prostituted themselves to other gods and worshipped them. Unlike their ancestors, they quickly turned from following the way of their ancestors, the way of obedience to God's commands. Whenever the Lord raised up a judge for him, he was with that judge and saved them out of the hands of their enemies as long as the judge lived. And it goes on and on. This cycle. Oh God, please save us. God raises up a judge. We'll follow the judge. Then the judge dies, and it's, oh God, save us again. Because they just couldn't break the cycle. So there's a couple of my favorite stories in here. First one is about Ehud. He's the second judge that's mentioned. And it says that Ehud was a left-handed man, right? Now, he was a Benjamite. He was from the tribe of Benjamin, and he was a left-handed man. And from what I understand, there were lots of lefties in the Benjamite camp. Don't know why. I have three brothers. Two of us are right-handed. Two of us are left-handed. I probably should have been left-handed, but my mom talked me out of it, I think, all right? And there are times when I'm working on something, especially under a car, where I'm trying to reach up with my right hand, and I say, oh, I wish my brother Alan was here, because he could reach this so much better than I can. But anyway. Ehud was left-handed. And the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord, and the king of Moab, whose name was Eglon, his mother must not have liked him very well. Eglon was the king of Moab, and he was riding roughshod over the Israelites. And it says that Ehud, this left-handed man, had a sword that he carried on his right hip, which means that he was reaching across to draw, which I don't really get, but that's the way he did it, all right? Well, I don't, yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense, doesn't it? Or you could just do it this way, I don't, on your back, I don't know. But anyway, he was left-handed, carried his sword on his right hip. It is a matter of record, 3,000 years old, says so in the Bible. So that's how he did it, okay? And he went to the king to pay him tribute, because that's what kings did. These warlords, they would take over a place and they would say, okay, I get whatever I want from you, and you have to come and pay me tribute. And it says that the Ehud went and presented his tribute to Eglon, the king of Moab, who was a very fat man. Not kind of fat, not pretty fat, very fat. Biblical fat, says so right here. Very fat man. So, he went and paid his tribute, and he left. And he gets out of town, and he says to his attendants, I'm going back. It's interesting. It's like he got so far, and he went, you know what? I am not going to take this anymore. I am tired of paying tribute to this fat man. So he goes back, and he says to King Eglon, I've got a secret that I need to tell you. So Eglon dismisses all of his servants. All you people, get out. Get out. Get out. And Ehud comes over to him and approached him while he was sitting alone in the upper room of his palace. Now, the upper room of the palace, probably something like a bathroom. Alright? It's probably where King Eglon, the fat king, went to do his business. Alright? And so Ehud says, I have a message of God from a message from God for you. And as the king rose from his seat, Ehud drew his sword from his right side and plunged it into King Eglon so far that his fat closed over the handle of his sword. Now think about this. The guy's got a sword that's a cubit plus long. So he's got a sword that's about 20 inches long plus the handle, right? The king's so fat that he sticks the whole thing in there and takes his hand out and walks away. So here's King Eglon with a big old sword that's swallowed up in his fat, and it says, remember the R rating, right? It says that he stabbed him right through the bowels and it got smelly fast. Ehud locked the door behind him and left. So King Eglon's servants come and they knock on the door and they knock on the door, and they're not hearing anything, but they're smelling something. And they're like, oh, he must be doing his kingly business. So they leave him alone while Ehud hits the streets, man. He is gone. And meanwhile, the servants are standing outside going, someone light a candle, please. Right? So that's what happened. While they waited, Ehud got away. He passed the stone images and escaped to Sarai. And they arrived there. He blew a trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim, and the Israelites went down with him from the hills, with him leading them. Follow me, for the Lord has given Moab, your enemy, into your hands. So they followed him down and took possession of all the fords of Jordan that led to Moab, and they allowed no one to cross over. At that time, they struck down about 10,000 Moabites, all vigorous and strong, not fat, and not one escaped. And that day, Moab was made subject to Israel, and the land had peace for 80 years. 80 years, because he stabbed a fat man. All right. I have another favorite story from this book. Deborah was a lady judge. Her judgeship, I don't know what they call her. But it says that she would sit at this place under the palm of Deborah. They named a tree after her. Her husband's name was Lapidoth, which, if you're looking for a name for your kid, might be a good one.
What does it mean?
I don't know what it means. So she would sit there, and the people would come to her, and she would settle their disputes and all that kind of thing. And I got to think that Deborah was a good person. She was probably a pretty cool person, because this is not a time when ladies were held in great esteem, right? So she must have had something going on. God had given her wisdom, that she would sit under this palm. Can't you see it? In some kind of probably chair. She probably had a little umbrella. And people would come to her and say, Miss Deborah, we've got an issue here. And she would help them figure it out. And she was I got a picture of a wise and kind kind of lady judge. Anyway, they were under sea attack. They were given a hard time by the king of Canaan, whose name was Jabin, and Sisera was the commander of his army. And he had 900 chariots, and he was just a pretty bad dude. And he oppressed the Israelites for 20 years, and then they cried for help. And Deborah, like I said, is under the tree of Deborah, and she's doing her thing, and she sent for Barak. It's interesting to me that this judge is named Ehud, and then we have Barak right after Nathan. So she sends for Barak, and she says, this is what God of Israel says. Go take 10,000 men of Naphtali and Zebulun, two of the tribes, lead them up to Mount Tabor, and go get Sisera. He's the commander of Jabin's army with his chariots and troops. God says, I will give them over to you. And Barak says to Deborah, if you'll go with me, I'll go. But if you don't go with me, I won't go. And Deborah says, tell you what, I'll go with you, but Sisera will be delivered into the hands of a woman. Now we all think, Deborah must be the woman, right? If we've got this kind of foreshadowing in the story, we can see what the end is, right? So they go up, and they do battle with Sisera and his folks, and they rout them terribly, and Sisera runs alone. He's out of there. He jumps off one of his 900 chariots and just runs. And he runs up this hill, and he runs down that hill, and he comes to a tent. And in the tent is a lady whose name is Jael. Jael went out to meet Sisera, and she said to him, "Come, my lord, come right in. Don't be afraid." So he entered her tent, and she covered him with a blanket. "I'm thirsty," he said. "Been fighting and running all day." So she, and he asked for some water, but she opened up a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him up. "Stand in the doorway of the tent," he told her. "If anyone comes by and asks you, 'Is there a man here?' say no." Good plan, all right? Great strategy. "I know how I'll hide. I'll hide under this carpet in the tent. I'll drink some milk, and I'll put a woman at the door and tell her to lie for me," right? Sisera fell asleep. He'd been fighting all day, fighting and running. He's under this carpet in the tent. He's got a belly full of milk. It's so cozy in there and peaceful. And Sisera lays down, and he goes to sleep. And the scripture says that Jael went and got a tent peg. These were... tent peg. These were big tents. How big a peg do you need to hold down a tent? A big tent. A big tent peg. So imagine something that's this big around and this long and sharp on one end. And she goes over to where Sisera is sleeping. And she kneels down beside him. And she says, "Sisera." And he goes, because it's all so nice and comfy under there. And she takes that tent peg that's this big around, and she puts the point of it on his temple and goes, whack! Right through. Drilled his head into the floor of her tent. I know, isn't it a great story? And there was peace in the land. And the victory went to a woman who didn't happen to be Deborah. Don't you love this stuff? I mean, we don't live like this anymore. There's probably a reason, right? What's the matter, Chrissy? You don't like that story?
So glad I came tonight.
I think guys had a different reaction to these kinds of stories. Because I take a look at how could you, the generations, if their whole life is get up, kill everybody and let no one live. Go in there, kill everybody and let no. What does that do to your population, to your culture? I could see where they got tired.
Right.
I'm thinking the women did some nagging. Just saying.
Well,
I can't watch it on TV, let alone pick up the hammer and do it. So
I don't leave any tent pegs laying around my house, I'll tell you that much.
I'm never looking at one the same again.
Do you have something for that, Mike? The violence of the warrior culture?
No.
Julia, I mean, anybody else have anything for that? The violence of the warrior culture? I mean, it is off-putting to us.
But it was what it was. I mean, in Ireland, that was during that time. I think that is how people live.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm just thankful I'm not there.
Yeah.
Right. It was brutal. It was brutal.
She must have been really strong to put a peg through a guy's head.
I mean,
you don't just...
She had a hammer.
She had a hammer.
Okay.
Yeah.
Probably had a hammer.